Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the March 2025 edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, A Hollywood Ending, A Titanic Achievement in Film, and How It Was Almost Forgotten, by John Simley. When Citizen Kane premiered on May 1, 1941, it wasn't at some historic Hollywood theater, or even at one of New York's fancy movie houses. Instead, the film, destined to become the most admired of all time, opened more modestly, at a former vaudeville hall on Broadway. All glitzier plans had been scuttled by newspaper tycoon William Randolph Hearst, who believed, correctly, that the film was a thinly veiled indictment of him. Hearst banned his many newspapers from even mentioning Orson Welles's filmmaking debut, and in many accounts, the magnate had offered a handsome bounty, worth more than the film's budget, to purchase the negatives, simply for the pleasure of destroying it. Welles later said a Hearst minion had tried, unsuccessfully, to frame Welles by sending a 14-year-old girl to his hotel room. It was a full-on campaign to derail the career of the 25-year-old filmmaker before it had begun. Thanks to Hearst's boycott, Citizen Kane was a box office flop, losing the studio, RKO, at least $150,000, a bit more than $3 million today, even though many early reviewers were gobsmacked. The critic, Bosley Crowther, writing in the New York Times, praised the outsize ambitions of writer, director, producer, star Welles, celebrating the young auteur for his brash style, which showed more verve and inspired ingenuity than any of the elder craftsmen have exhibited in years. Equal parts bootstrap fable, think Horatio Alger, and tragedy, think Dr. Faustus, the movie tells the life story of Charles Foster Kane, who rises from a modest Colorado boarding house to the highest echelons of American power, as a cocksure media magnate whose meaty fingers could tip the scale of world power, and whose cryptic last word before dying, Rosebud, provides the mystery that drives the film. Yet Welles's startlingly new approach to visual storytelling elevated the rags-to-riches template into high tragedy and uncomfortable satire. Bucking convention at every turn, Welles skipped around chronology freely, using inventive dissolves and edits to move the viewer back and forth in time. The small touches were groundbreaking. One famous shot in the first minutes of the film, showing reflections in a smashed snow globe, anticipates the film's grand schemes of ambition and legacy, and the cracked mirror of memory. Welles attributed these innovations to his own ignorance as a first-time filmmaker, entering Hollywood from a career in theater and radio. "It's only when you know something about a profession," he told an interviewer, "that you're timid or careful." After its unhappy opening in the United States, the film receded until a detailed 1947 essay by the French critic André Bazin, who went on to co-found the iconic French film magazine Cahiers du Cinéma, hailed Citizen Kane as a revolution in film language. French critics and filmmakers championed the film, and Americans gave it another chance. It was released for a second time in the States in 1956 to a broader and more appreciative audience. By 1962, a survey of around 70 esteemed movie critics hailed it as the greatest movie ever made. It is also one of the most influential. In particular, Welles's endless capacity for experimentation, combined with his bull-headed persona, was a central inspiration for the new Hollywood directors of the 1970s. The one key element we learned from Welles was the power of ambition, the director Martin Scorsese once said. He is responsible for inspiring more people to be film directors than anyone else in the history of the cinema. In a tragic turn, Hearst's hatred managed to do lasting damage to Welles professionally. The brilliant filmmaker and star found himself having to battle with studios for artistic control, often struggling to fund projects for the rest of his life, and never once made a movie that turned a profit in his lifetime. Welles once joked of his career, quote, "Begin at the top and have been working my way down ever since," end of quote. The long shadow of Hearst's curse has only deepened the sense of mystique around Welles's most famous and, in some ways, most enigmatic movie. One could argue that Welles has triumphed against Hearst in the Battle of Legacies, so the Hearst estate seemed to admit in 2015, when it finally screened Citizen Kane at the Magnet's famously garish castle in San Simeon, California. Regardless, the film's scandalous backstory remains an essential element of its all-American greatness. In her 1971 book-length New Yorker essay about the film's production, critic Pauline Kael contended that Hearst ultimately became the victim of his own style of journalism. That is to say, Welles had matched Hearst in his capacity for sensationalism, crafting a brilliant feature film that doubled as its own sort of yellow journalism. In this way, Citizen Kane was not only a high watermark for the American cinema circa 1941, it also anticipated reality television, the celebrity flogging of TMZ, plus other, arguably more execrable, trends in American entertainment and public life. It is a towering artistic achievement, shot through the inky grease of tabloid sleaze. And that completes the article. The title was A Hollywood Ending by John Simley. Our next article is Macbeth Goes to Haiti. Welles's bold staging of Shakespeare's classic helped make Harlem a home for serious theater by Brandon Tinsley. On the night of April 14, 1936, traffic on 7th Avenue near 131st Street in New York City's Harlem neighborhood was at a virtual standstill, the roads jammed for 10 blocks, the sort of throngs you'd expect for a generational prize fight, all of them hoping to get a ticket to the most sensational show in town, a curious adaptation of Macbeth, directed by a dramaturgical wunderkind named Orson Welles, under the aegis of the Federal Theater Project, a New Deal program designed to help support the arts. It was an era of artistic and political daring, led by the luminaries of the Harlem Renaissance, and Wells, then just 20, and already a respected interpreter of Shakespeare, was debuting one of the boldest productions in the history of American theater. Wells adapted Shakespeare's text himself, significantly revising details, moving the setting from Scotland to Haiti, and featuring an all-black cast. In his staging, Wells also swapped medieval witchcraft for voodoo rituals, hence the production's nickname, Voodoo Macbeth. Black audiences initially feared that, in the hands of a white director, the production might make a mockery of black cultural practices. Such concerns evaporated on that buzzy April night in 1936 at the Lafayette Theater. By all metrics, Voodoo Macbeth was a smash, as critics fawned over the performances, the eye-popping costumes, and the voodoo drumming. As one reviewer wrote of a particularly hypnotic moment in the drumming, "If it doesn't make you feel the creeps, you are unimaginative indeed." A sparkle always came to Wells's eye whenever he thought back on the production. "By all odds, my great success in my life was that play," he recalled in a 1982 BBC interview. "Everybody who was anybody in the black or white world was there, and when the play ended, there were so many curtain calls that finally they left the curtain open, and the audience came up on the stage to congratulate the actors." Debuting amid Jim Crow, Voodoo Macbeth not only provided critical work to black New Yorkers amid the Great Depression, 150 cast members were involved, but also elevated black actors in New York and beyond. After finishing its sold-out 10-week run at the Lafayette, the production toured cities from Dallas to Indianapolis to Syracuse. At a time of deep racial prejudice, Wells's Voodoo Macbeth granted black Americans some semblance of equality, and on the stage, it allowed them to bewitch the world. That completes the article titled "Macbeth Goes to Haiti" by Brandon Tinsley. Our next article is titled "Taking the Lead: How Alice Hamilton Waged a One-Woman Campaign Against a Toxic and Ubiquitous Material" by Daniel Stone. One day in March of 1911, the same month as the infamous Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire in New York City that trapped and killed 146 workers, a woman named Alice Hamilton arrived at the Sangamon Street Works, a lead smelting plant on Chicago's east side, and asked to take a look around. The owner welcomed her in. She was a small woman, unassuming. What harm could she bring to a powerful boss? She walked by the kettles and furnaces. She observed the sweating men holding shovels and prods. The air was stifling, full of humidity, and several times she covered her nose and mouth to dampen the scent of industrial chemicals wafting through the unventilated rooms. On the floor were pieces of scrap metal and a film of metallic dust, some of which also floated visibly in the air. A few men wore dirty uniforms, but most donned the same stained overalls they wore at home each night. There was a pile in one corner of large rubber respirators, but none of the men were using them. A few of them had tied dirty handkerchiefs around their mouths. Hamilton walked around with a pen and pad in hand, listening. One man told her about a young immigrant from Bulgaria who'd been working here but had seemed to go crazy a few weeks earlier. The worker was removed from the plant in a straitjacket and later died. She heard of another man, also an immigrant, who was put to work making paste for batteries, and had a habit of moistening his fingers on his tongue. He lasted 10 days before he went home ill. One foreman told Hamilton that few of his men could work for more than a few weeks before they called in sick. Almost all had suffered the same symptoms, starting with hallucinations. The boss offered no payment for sick workers, and he didn't appear to be making much effort to prevent them from getting sick. Many times I met men who employed foreign-born labor because it was cheap and submissive, and then washed their hands of all responsibility, she wrote. They deliberately chose such men because it meant a surplus of eager, undemanding labor. In a time of booming production and thousands of new factories buzzing across America, Hamilton was arguably the first American physician to take a professional interest in the health and safety of workers, and one of the first to try to make American industries safer. She came to the dangerous trades, as she called them, in an indirect way. Born in 1869 into a wealthy family, Hamilton grew up on a sprawling estate that covered 3 city blocks in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Educated at Miss Porter's, an elite boarding school in Farmington, Connecticut, she went to medical school in Michigan, graduating in 1893. A doctor at 24, Hamilton could have taken her skills and privileged background in any direction. But something about her upbringing, the importance of being helpful, as her father, a businessman, had urged her to be, drove her to help the most marginalized people win political and social power. A century later, Alice Hamilton's work reaches deep into every aspect of modern life. She laid the foundation for occupational health and safety standards that protect millions of workers worldwide. She broke gender barriers in the broader sciences that opened stodgy, male-dominated fields to women. And her approach to social justice, combining evidence-based research, interdisciplinary collaboration, and community engagement, remains the blueprint for nearly all public health and policy fights today, from the smallest neighborhood disputes to global battles over pollution, natural resources, and climate change. But her battles were never easy, nor did vindication come quickly, and one battle stood high above the rest because it would pit her against a deadly poison that would go on to sicken millions around the world. Lead, number 82 on the periodic table, was a miracle metal for thousands of years. The Roman Empire considered lead the everything element, the plastic of its era. It made pots last longer. It helped winemaking urns resist bacteria, and it made pigments in makeup brighter on people's faces. Its resistance to corrosion, meanwhile, made it the perfect material for water pipes in homes, which Romans called plumbing, from the Latin word for lead, plumb bum. In medical school, Hamilton learned that lead was poisonous. The element had been known for millennia to bring out a person's insanity, and historians had even debated whether Romans' ubiquitous use of lead had hastened the collapse of their empire. By 1900, America was a top miner of lead in the world. The country's appetite was endless for its industrial and cosmetic uses, and even as a miracle health cure. Marketers sprung lead as the key to a more prosperous life, and promoted using it in cosmetics, medicines, and children's toys. But lead also had a dark side. The element had become so ubiquitous that in 1910, the governor of Illinois asked Hamilton to investigate the conditions in factories that made lead and other chemicals, where men were getting sick and often dying in numbers too high to ignore. In 1921, an engineer at General Motors found another use for lead. He put a few drops into gasoline and found it reduced a phenomenon of incomplete fuel combustion, known as engine knock. In the 1920s, a decade of robust American growth in every direction, this new substance, called tetraethyl lead gasoline, quickly literally fueled more powerful cars, more prosperous cities, and a country on the rise. But Hamilton saw a distinct threat. The first female professor at Harvard, she was acutely familiar with lead's toxicity from her research among workers in Illinois, and she sought to convince the public that chronic low-level lead exposure from trace amounts in leaded gasoline was just as dangerous as lead poisoning, such as when a soldier suffered from a lead bullet wound. In 1922, the year after tetraethyl lead gasoline was invented, Hamilton became certain that it was a terrible idea, a historic blunder. She would spend much of the 1920s on an almost religious crusade against leaded gasoline. "This is a very dangerous form of lead," she later wrote, based on her experience as a doctor and investigator. She believed tetraethyl lead would cause insomnia, excitement, twitching muscles, hallucinations like those of delirium tremens, even maniacal attacks and convulsions and death. She wrote letters to the Surgeon General and contributed to a series of Harvard studies into lead poisoning that showed that lead ingested in almost any quantity corrupted almost every organ. She wrote a nearly 600-page book about industrial poisons in the United States that devoted 14 of its 38 chapters to lead. She also leaned heavily on her friend Walter Lippmann, the famed progressive journalist for the powerful New York World newspaper, to launch a forceful campaign against tetraethyl lead and the lead industry. "Publicity is a wonderful thing," she remarked. "It may be the pebble with which David will kill Goliath." Hamilton did not mince words. Even when dealing with the most powerful men in high positions of America's industrial companies. When the U.S. Public Health Service was debating the pros and cons of lead gasoline in May 1925, she walked right up to Charles Kettering, head of research for General Motors, and declared, "You're nothing but a murderer." Kettering laughed off the insult. He was a powerful man with the backing of a friendly government. He had reasons to think that Americans everywhere happy in their powerful cars, transforming American life, were rooting for him to succeed. Hamilton eventually lost the fight. Leaded gasoline went on to flood the country in the 1930s and 40s. Once the U.S. government helped export it overseas, it was everywhere. Leaded gasoline simply became gasoline. Hamilton's vindication would eventually come. She spent the next 40 years warning about the dangers of dozens of hazardous chemicals, including mercury, radium, asbestos, and carbon monoxide. She wrote two more books, including her 1934 tome, Industrial Toxicology, which became an authoritative reference guide for workplace inspectors and industrial safety experts. By the time Hamilton died in 1970 at the age of 101, she had done an enormous amount of work and seen a remarkable amount of change in her lifetime, from Reconstruction to men landing on the moon. But her legacy would be comparatively small. She was not prone to command attention, seek out fame, or try to enlarge her profile. She did not make large endowments that would adorn buildings with her name or fund future students with scholarships. She never married and did not have children who might have promoted her legacy or safeguarded her records. But in the 1970s, the burgeoning environmental movement and advancing medical research caught up to Hamilton, and the country began to see dynamic leaps of progress that would long outlive her. 3 months after Hamilton died in September 1970, a year marked by major expansions of environmental policy, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act, a landmark law that had long last established a baseline for many of the healthy working conditions that Hamilton had spent a lifetime advocating for. A new government agency known as OSHA would set and enforce standards for job training and safety, and the law provided an avenue for the first time for workers to confidentially ask the government to inspect their workplaces for toxic and unsafe conditions. In the years that followed, a protection for clean air and drinking water, combining human health into the broader ethos of environmentalism. Meanwhile, the U.S. began a mandated phase-down of leaded gasoline in 1975, and other countries followed until Algeria became the last country to phase out the fuel in 1921. On Hamilton's 100th birthday, Nixon wrote to Hamilton, then practically on her deathbed, to thank her for her century of work to improve people's lives. That's the end of the article. The title was Taking the Lead by Daniel Stone. And that's the end of the program today. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your reader today. I've been reading the March 2025 issue of the magazine. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and if you missed an article, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll find a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.